Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. The U.S. Department of the Treasury has sanctioned three former Sudanese officials for their role in destabilizing peace in Sudan.
In the mind of the United States government, the actions that these three men were involved in constituted a process to undermine the democratic process in Sudan.
And South Sudanese activists highlight that exorbitant bride prices or dowries in certain communities expose women to abuse by their husbands.
Just from nowhere, he started beating me, boxing me, strangulating me, and I kept crying, shouting for help. All my neighbors ran to see what was happening, but because he had broken the gate, the key for the gate, no one could come in to even rescue me.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office for Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has sanctioned three former Sudanese officials who serve in the ousted President Omar al-Bashir's administration. They include Salah Ghosh, the ex-spy chief, and Taha Osman, the former presidential office director. OFAC said these sanctions, announced on Monday, aim to counter the officials' involvement in destabilizing Sudan's peace, security, and stability. OFAC said the economic sanctions and asset freezes support international diplomatic efforts to resolve the current Sudanese conflict between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. For insight, I spoke with Brian Adeba, a senior policy advisor with the investigative group The Century.
If you look at the statement from the State Department, it accused them of facilitating a number of things for both sides in the conflict. One person, Salah Ghosh, for instance, and the other person who is the, I forget his name now, who is the head of the, former head of the National Intelligence and Security Service in Sudan, together with Salah Ghosh, who was also head of the security agency, accused of undermining democracy. One person has been accused of supporting the RSF. So those are the crimes that are, that they are accused of. And in the mind of the United States government, the actions that these three men were involved in constituted a process to undermine the democratic process in Sudan.
Yes, the other guy I'm looking at it here is Mohammed Atal Mulla Abbas. And it's interesting that the other guy, Taha Osman, who was director in the office of Omar al-Bashir, the former ousted president, ended up supporting the other side, the RSF.
RSF. Yes, I mean, in the political marketplace in Sudan, there have been significant changes in allegiance, and there has been a switch. As you see, this is someone who worked for Omar al-Bashir, but he was a key supporter of the RSF. In fact, he is mentioned as being instrumental in having the act that legitimized the RSF as one of the security forces of Sudan in 2017.
And what can we hope that this will achieve? And what seems to be the broader strategy here for the U.S.?
In and of themselves, these actions, the sanctions against the three individuals, while commendable, is not going to bring an end to the fighting. These sanctions need to be supplemented by other measures. For instance, while you sanction someone to send a signal that, you know, if you're not serious about peace, these are some of the consequences that your officials will face, it's also important to look at the diplomatic strategy to achieve peace, so that there should be a diplomatic strategy that complements the sanctions. For instance, the appointment of the U.S. should appoint a special envoy for Sudan. A presidential envoy, actually, would be preferable. And this person should be reporting directly to the White House, to the office of the president, the White House in the United States, rather than to the the department in the United States State Department, which is just focused on African affairs. That will be junior, because the a presidential envoy who is reporting directly to President Biden would be seen to have more clout with the Sudanese actors in the conflict and with the region and the mediators and other actors in the conflict that are accused of supporting both sides. For instance, the United States, the United Arab Emirates, Chad, Egypt, and even Saudi Arabia. So it's important to have someone of that stature and significance reporting directly to the president.
Finally, I noticed that all three individuals who are sanctioned this time around belong to the former administration of Omar al-Bashir, including his former spy chief, Salah Ghosh, and the director, Taha Usman. But no one who is now active holding office right now. The other thing, there are atrocities that are ongoing now in Darfur and other places across Sudan being reported by human rights organizations. It seems the State Department is considering, or maybe a little bit behind the news, like they're not responding to what's happening directly now. How do you read this?
Well, I think I read from the perspective of access to information. If you're going to sanction someone, you must have information about them that indicates that they're complicit in some wrongdoing. And I believe that is actually a challenge for anyone who's trying to hold anybody accountable in a conflict zone. I think that I'm not a member of the United States government, but I would think that they are in the process of probably gathering more information. And when they do have information, probably such measures will be enacted.
That's Brian Adeba, a senior policy advisor with the Sentry, a policy group that investigates dirty money connected to African war criminals. He spoke with me from D.C. this past hour. VOA made several attempts to reach Sudan's ambassador to the United States, Mohamed Idris, for comment on the sanctions without success. A gender-based violence survivor in Juba says exorbitant bride price or dowry in some communities exposes women to abuse by their husbands. Some Juba residents say some men become angry and treat women like personal property after paying a bride price. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
28-year-old Gladys Kiden says her husband subjected her to both emotional and physical abuse. Kiden, a nurse and a mother of 2 years, says she lost another pregnancy after her husband beat her to near death because she asked him to pay 2,000 South Sudanese pounds as compensation for a full tray of eggs her daughter broke.
Just from nowhere, he started beating me, boxing me, strangulating me, and I kept crying, shouting for help. All my neighbors ran to see what was happening, but because he had broken the gate, the key for the gate, no one could come in to even rescue me.
Kiden says she went back to her family house, but felt disappointed after her family members forced her to return to her abusive husband, arguing he already paid her bride price. She urges communities and families to value their children's lives more than the bride price paid by the groom's family and to stop normalizing abuse by men.
Do you know how much I can get in place of those dowries if I am leaving? What you should value is not whatever they have paid after me, but value my life. And I would also tell any other parent or any other community member that you should value the life of your child or your relative, because there is so much she can bring to the community or to the family as long as she's living.
Juba resident Stephen Lubang says high bride price in some communities is leading to gender-based violence and an increase in the rate at which marriages are breaking. Lubang says many men brutalize their wives because they are furious after paying many heads of cattle or a huge amount of money as bride price.
It is because of carried anger. I have already paid. I have paid this, so I decide whatever I want to do. That is an anger. That is not true that they are not educated. They are educated. They may understand even the way of life very well. They may be able to take care of a family. But because of the anger of the bride price, of the money I have paid, of the cows I have paid, of the chicken I have paid, I have to deal with you the way I want to deal with you.
Lobang urges families and communities at large to stop commercializing their daughters, saying bride price should be nothing more than a token of appreciation to the bride's family. He encourages young people to fight for their rights and convince their families to reduce bride price.
I think it is high time we also try to advocate for our rights. As young people, first of all, I want to get married, you want to get married. It is us to talk to our parents that, look, don't sell us as ladies, but also as young men, we talk to our parents that, look, talk to yourselves so that you are able to lower these prices, otherwise we become thieves.
He then says she encountered challenges after deciding to leave her abusive marriage, but receive assistance from a women's rights organization.
I could ask relatives, you know, they told me no, they don't want someone to come back home, you know, you have to stay in your marriage, even if that problem has happened like that. And I'm like, I cannot go back there. Someone has beaten me to death point, again you're sending me there. What do you think he will do next?
He then says she had no money to leave and in the beginning slept in a corridor of woman's home in her tribe. She is calling on the government and non-governmental organizations working to prevent gender-based violence to do more to educate communities about the dangers of abusing women and girls. He then also encourages married women to speak up against all forms of violence. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Aman Adam, a Sudanese refugee residing in Gorom refugee camp in Juba County, shares the challenging journey that many asylum seekers face when crossing into South Sudan. Adam says the trek from Khartoum to South Sudan was arduous, spanning several weeks before he finally reached Juba, where he found refuge. He spoke with my colleague John Tanza, who was at the camp.
Well, after war started, by the duration like for 1 month, I started leaving Sudan and came into the South Sudan, crossed the border through Jodah and through Rang. I came through there until I reached here, South Sudan, Juba. As soon as when I reached here, I heard that there is a camp opening for the refugees. So as soon as when I got that news, I decided to come and be a part of this camp.
What are some of the issues in the camp here since you came?
Since I came at the beginning, one of the most biggest challenges that which I faced when we came, there were no shelters to rest or even to sleep inside. So we used to sleep outside there. We started at that time. We were inside the school. Then we have been deported in order to go out of the school. We were asked to get out of the school. So we went out, and we were staying at the roads here for almost like 20 days until I just finished my registration procedures. Then I became a refugee officially. After that, I have been given my ration card, and then I received sorghum and oil and salt and some other things also, food items. Despite of the things that we have received or we are still receiving, it looks that that is not enough, because after you receive that food ration, after that you go there and you just live in your shelters, but you will not have, I think that there is no enough food, and also there is no other resources to enable you in order to get enough food for you and for the others, for the other families also.
How are you surviving?
Now, most of the challenges about that, I think that we are only getting 8,000 per only 1 month, 8,000. But after we came as in the leadership, we asked for the management of the camp in order to try and increase their money. Now today, on this particular day, I think that they have increased the money from $8 into something like 12,900 pound, South Sudanese pound. I don't know exactly how much does it equal in dollar. The way how we are living here is very difficult. Even though some of the organizations are trying to come and make other alternatives like project for cultivation in order to let people go and try to cultivate in order to increase the resources to enable them live with dignity and a better way. We always urge the humanitarian organization in order to come and try to elevate from the level of this primary health care into a hospital where we can get more medical expertise, where we can get more medications, and where it can work for 24 hours. Because this hospital here, I think it is working only, this primary health care, PHC, is working only during daytime from 9 o'clock up to 3 o'clock.
It's for a temporary situation because a refugee camp is not a permanent settlement. So you also need to understand.
I understand that, but also, according to the community that we found here, they have 13 years here, which means that that is not 100% possible.
What do you want to be done?
We want at least, in the term of health care, they should try and at least improve from the situation of this primary health care center or clinic and to be elevated into a hospital where we can get the services 24 hours. Because during Saturdays and Sundays even, there is no services at all, which means that if you have a malaria, you have to wait for almost from, you say, for example, if it is today, it's Friday, 3 or 4 o'clock. It means that you have to wait for Saturdays or Sunday until Monday comes. Then you go there in order to try to do a checkup to find, to seek a medical treatment, which extends the suffer of the refugees.
That's Imam Adam, a Sudanese refugee residing at the Gorom refugee camp on the outskirts of the South Sudanese capital, Juba. He spoke with my colleague John Tanza during a recent visit to the camp. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the Democratic Republic of Congo is gearing up for elections. Stay tuned.
Around the world, people are marking the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Help us mark the work to end violence against women by sharing your thoughts on VOA's English to Africa radio programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076 before December 10th. Tell us what is being done in your community to fight gender-based violence and tell us why this issue is important to you. That number again is +1 202 258 3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The GovAI conference, hosted on December 5th and 6th, 2023, is a conference in which artificial intelligence or AI software developers are converging with government agencies, militaries, and educational institutions to make the case for AI's use in the public sector. VOA's Anthony Labruto is live at the conference and joins us from the venue. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hello, Nabil. Thank you very much.
Tell us, where are you right now, where this conference is being held and what is happening?
So right now I am in coastal city, Virginia, which is just across the Potomac River from the Voice of America studios. And so far at this conference, and I'd like to point out that this is the first of its kind U.S.-based artificial intelligence government summit, there's been several presentations from artificial intelligence developers, the keynote speaker being OpenAI, that's one of the founders of ChatGPT, and a lot of smaller startups that are looking to grow their business towards the government. And there's also been presentations from different United States government agencies, most notably the Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration that oversees things like airports and scanning luggages, that, things like that. So far, from what I've seen, is there's been both sides of this summit, that is the artificial intelligence developers and government agencies, public sector workers, are listening to one another about what the public sector is looking for in artificial intelligence, and in turn, what can artificial intelligence developers do that they aren't currently doing that, that can be adapted for government use.
So, yeah, what is this need? What is the case being made right now for artificial intelligence or AI to be incorporated in the public sector?
From what I've learned, particularly from the government agencies speaking at this conference, there's kind of been this sort of underlying fear of artificial intelligence taking over the current technology conversation and security really being at the heart of that. And so artificial intelligence is being utilized and developed quicker and quicker since the creation of ChatGPT as the first major, what developers call, interactive language model that people can communicate with. And government agencies, and especially ones like the Transportation Security Administration that I mentioned earlier, are keen to embrace the technology because they know it's effective, but don't really know where to start. And some of the government representatives I've spoken to kind of on the side of this are a little concerned that they've fallen too far behind the curve in embracing this extremely effective technology. But really the underlying theme of this conference has been to change that concern with excitement for the future and what can artificial intelligence do for the government and the public sector.
Indeed, the security concern is, of course, around data security, which one expects, resistance from public sector regarding embracing AI. Is that being played out? Is that happening right now at the conference?
Based on what I've seen kind of so far in the beginning of the first day, at least from a United States perspective, the fact that these two groups can come together to even create a better software is a step in the right direction. And these artificial intelligence models can be applied in a variety of ways, as I've learned so far, from firefighting to first responders and doctors to airport security, trains and subways. And so the smaller tech exhibitions that I've seen from artificial intelligence companies themselves that are happening on the main floor of this event space, as I'm speaking to you from, are marketing heavily in the question, what can we do for you? How can we put your mind at ease about security, about utilization? And at this point, I'm not sure too many people here at the conference from at least the government and public sector perspective can answer that question very specifically, but the fact that there's a willingness from both sides to even want to be a part of the other's conversation, I think would be an encouraging sign for the artificial intelligence industry, Nabil.
So there seems to be indeed a willingness at least to work through the issues and the concerns people in public sector might have about AI.
Yes, and that I think that's the reason that this conference was called to kind of call together, because the Biden administration had signed a lot of these executive orders promising the implementation of artificial intelligence, promising more money towards it. But a lot of the government agencies, at least, were asking, what does that look like? We want to use artificial intelligence in what we're doing right now, but we don't really know where to start. And I think those companies are also taking note of what software, how can we better even market the software or apply the software towards specific government needs.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Anthony. That's my colleague, Anthony Labruto. He joined me live from the conference venue in Virginia. Now we go to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where political parties are campaigning ahead of elections scheduled for December 2024. Candidates in the presidential, legislative, and municipal polls are working hard to vote to woo voters, even though they are encountering logistical problems and there are reported attacks on motorcades. A supporter of Mweze Katumbi was recently killed as the opposition presidential candidate prepared to hold a rally. Zanem Neti Zaidi has details.
As the election campaign continues for the general elections this month, several candidates are facing problems making themselves known or even getting around the country. Joël Bill is one of two female presidential candidates. She says there are problems of movement within the capital as well as within the provinces, and also problems of visibility. If you are looking for advertising, for example, there aren't any billboards left in the city because, she says, one candidate has single-handedly requisitioned 600 of them. Bile was referring to President Felix Tshisekedi and his campaign's dominance on advertising billboards. A few days ago, Moise Katumbi's political party, Ensemble pour la République, or Together for the Republic, reported that DRC authorities refused to grant overflight and landing permission to aircraft for its candidate's campaign. His motorcade was attacked last Tuesday in Kindu, the capital of Maniema province, and one of his officials was killed. But Together for the Republic spokesman Hervé Diakese says the party refuses to escalate the situation. He says they are in a position to respond, but he says for the sake of democracy and the best interests of the people, and because they know the next president of the Republic, Moise Katumbi, is leading a campaign of national reconciliation, they are refraining from behaving in ways that are not in keeping with democratic behavior. Last week, six presidential candidates threatened to lodge complaints against the president of the Electoral Commission for irregularities surrounding the electoral process and against the Minister of Interior for failing to protect candidates. However, Peter Kazadi, Minister of Interior, rejects the accusations against him. He says that opponents have the right to come and say what they see as the shortcomings of the police officers assigned to their custody, but that does not give them the right to publicly accuse the Minister of the Interior of refusing to provide them with police officers. The election campaign has now entered a new phase with growing competition between the two main candidates, President Tshisekedi and challenger Katumbi. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Netizaidi.
And that's all we have for you this Tuesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Mama Sokoto by Tutu. We've been listening to Mama Sokoto by Tutu. I am your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Ofori, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Tanner, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mama, Sanko, Tetsi, Lek, Mama, Mamburo, yeah.